You are listening to KPOO, San Francisco, 89.5 FM. You've reached Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, here on KPOO Radio and Healthful Living. I'm Julie Matthews. I'm a certified nutrition consultant with Healthful Living, and I have my co-host.
I'm Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist and Healthful Living advocate with Healthful Living.
And you can tune in every Thursday at noon during your lunchtime hour for Reality Sandwich. Today, we have a great guest on, and this has a lot of, I don't know if I want to say commonality, or is very in line with our message of healthful living, which is how we can support ourselves, of course, on the physical level, but also on the emotional, spiritual, and getting support within our community, and all of those great ways that we can support ourselves as individuals and as a community. And today we have a wonderful guest on, and her name is Julie Motz, M-O-T-Z, and she has written a book called Hands of Life. And she is one of the first non-traditional healers allowed to work in an operating room. Julie harnesses the body's own energy to help patients survive risky operations such as heart transplants and cancer surgery. She's worked in surgery at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center in the emergency room, as well as many other hospitals across the country, including Columbia Presbyterian in New York and Stanford University Hospital as well. In working side by side with surgeons, Julie has discovered the profound emotional journeys and causes that underlie the path of disease. Her work consists of being with patients before, during, and after their surgeries to resolve emotions that contribute to their physical illness. In this way, body, mind, and spirit are treated as an interconnected whole, making true healing a real possibility. Julie Motz has been profiled on Dateline and CNN and in the New York Times Magazine, New Age Journal, Ladies Home Journal, and more. And she currently lives here in the Bay Area. And as I mentioned, she has a wonderful book out and also teaches all sorts of wonderful healing groups and classes all over. So we are going to learn more about her.
Well, it's like, what could be more on the broader subject of healthful living? Because we all want to be more healthier and happier. And the further we go forward in time, the more that we're learning about the interconnectedness of all things, and particularly the interconnectedness of mind and body and the influence of emotions and our past experiences on our current health and well-being and way of being.
And I think that's, you know, really important, because in the mainstream, in mainstream medicine, sometimes you hear a little bit about the emotional component, but often it's very different. Physical disease is considered physical disease, and everything else that contributes to, or anything that contributes to it, is somehow, you know, genetic or biochemical. And while some of those things are true, that those are not the only pieces, and we're learning more and more through scientific study as well as experiences from doctors that the emotional component really plays a big factor. And for some of us, believe that the emotional components are, and the traumas that we experience are many of the things that actually create a lot of this illness.
Well, we're learning that the body is holding on to things, and it's manifesting in all kinds of different ways. And the more that we can learn about that, the more that we can empower ourselves to take some sort of action to help remedy what's going on inside.
Absolutely. So let's see if we can get Julie on the line. Julie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. Well, it's wonderful to have you on.
I was just saying, your tagline is a palatable
taste of the truth.
Yes. Well, I'm so glad to be included in that category, because so often people find my truths unpalatable. In fact, you know, one of the most revolutionary ideas that I propose is that the truth is actually healthy for you.
Mm.
There's some kind of idea out that lying is good and protective and telling the truth is bad and hurtful. I have exactly the opposite idea. I think the body does not accept lying. And lying about the truth of our history, and particularly what happened to us as children, is profoundly unhealthy for the body.
Well, historically, it's been, you know, there's been this this cultural thing about sucking it up, or just, you know, forgetting about it, or ignoring it, or suppressing it, or, you know, just it'll go away somehow. And I don't know that that really plays out well in the long term.
Well, it's partly the result of being a country that's a pioneer country, where in order to survive, we had to separate ourselves from our mother country, from the past. And pretend that it didn't exist and that we were independent, but I think it's more profound. Children have to suck it up all the time. Children have to constantly go along with the adult agenda. Babies have to have needs ignored. You know, a mother, it isn't convenient for a mother suddenly to feed a child when the child is hungry. So we actually, you know, in a very unnatural way, ask the people who need the most to be indulged and the most to be supported and the most to live in their complete emotional lives to suck it up the most. And that becomes a pattern, and a very dangerous pattern in our bodies. And I've seen over and over again, from very serious diseases to, you know, sort of more minor chronic pain, that this history of having not just our emotions but our physical needs as infants and children denied stays in the body and begins to undermine the body.
That's so interesting, because we often think, or we hear, I don't think this for sure, but that, oh, you know, this tragic death of Heath Ledger and his daughter is only two, and then you hear stuff about, oh, well, she's not going to remember it and all this stuff, and I, you know, horrified to think that on whether, you know, on any comment having to do with that, that how could you not be traumatized and on some level remember in the body what you went through, and I'm sure form certain, you know, belief systems or ways of seeing the world.
It's so bizarre to imagine that things that happen in our most formative years, when we learn the most, and I'm including 0 to 9 in the womb and infancy, that the things that happen as you're first learning about life will have less of an effect on you than the things you know when your belief system is in place. That's absurd. It's totally unscientific and counterintuitive. Those have the most profound effect on you, particularly if there is no comforting adult around to listen to your emotional response to a traumatic situation, as so often happens because adults are so involved in their own responses or in denying their responses. You know, I see this happens over and over again. As someone comes to me and, let's say, the family moved when they were, you know, 4, and they were yanked away from all their friends, and nobody ever stopped to ask them if they wanted to move. Nobody ever stopped to comfort them about what this dislocation meant for them. So, you know, this happens over and over again. And the truth is, the earlier something happens to you in your life, the more profound the effect is on you, not the less profound.
Right. What are some of the things that you learned in the emergency room and in surgery about what's going on for people, how these illnesses are created, and what's behind them?
Well, I had, you know, I started working out in heart transplant surgery. I mean, that was the first place that I worked. And I discovered, one of the interesting things I discovered is that the people who had the greatest fear of the needle were people who had been beaten as children. Because they associated pain with punishment. And they were the ones who had the least tolerance for pain and really couldn't stand, like, seeing the hypodermic go in. And that was a very, very early correlation, because I asked people a lot about their childhood. But one of the most striking things that happened is I was working in a heart transplant. And we usually know where the hearts come from. And when the heart was brought into the room, I got an image of a car driving on a rainy night, and two people in the car arguing, yelling, and screaming. And I asked the surgeon I was working with, I said, well, how do we get the heart? He said, oh, it was a car accident. The mother was dying, and the mother was driving, and the daughter was killed. And I thought, oh, God, that's interesting. And when they put the heart into the body, it refused to beat, you know, which, of course, is every surgeon's nightmare, every transplant surgeon's nightmare. And I had worked a lot with the woman who was on the table, and I knew that she had been, you know, very badly hit as a child, and that she was terrified of getting angry, of standing up for anything. And then here you have this heart. It comes in, and what's the message it gets? If you get angry, like if you get in an argument, you're going to get killed.
Right.
So I began talking to both the heart and the woman. I said, you know, it's safe to be angry. You know, this is one time when you have to have that really aggressive energy and stand up for yourself. You really have to be there. You have to show presence. You have to show up for yourself. And the heart starts to beat.
Wow.
And the anesthesiologist said to me later, he said, I don't know what you did, because they had poured all kinds of chemicals in. They had tried the paddles. Nothing had worked. But I've never seen a heart come back so far and so fast.
Wow.
So that was where the emotional truth, putting two and two together, the emotional truth of this person's history, the emotional message the heart was following enabled me to, you know, to give an emotional message in an emergency situation that literally saved somebody's life.
Wow. How did you get into the hospital, into the emergency room? This is a rare occurrence that doctors do this sort of thing.
Well, I was getting a master's in public health at Columbia University, sort of thinking I would go into healthcare administration and change the world that way, although I very quickly realized I wasn't, you know, cut out to be behind a desk. And at just about that time, Columbia had gotten a grant to set up an alternative medicine center that they were terrified to use. Hmm. The lawyers were just terrified of what was going to happen if people were calling Columbia University and getting advice on alternative medicine. But there was a young surgeon in cardiothoracic surgery named Mehmet Oz, who's since become very well known as a popularizer of, you know, medicine and health. And he was sort of curious about this. So I became a consultant to the cardiothoracic surgery department. He called me in. And I began working with his patients before and after surgery. And it was kind of funny. He would... I called a couple of friends of mine who are also energy healers, and what would happen is, you know, Mehmet would go into the room and he'd talk to the patient and he'd point to me and he'd say, "And this is my colleague, Miss Motz, and she's going to do..." And he'd mumble something that I couldn't understand and the paper couldn't understand and the patient couldn't understand. And he said, "Is that all right?" And they'd look up at this tall, good-looking guy, because he looks so much like a cross between, you know, Clark Gable and Omar Sharif, and they say, and he just saved their life after all. And they say, "Oh yes, Dr. Oz, that would be just fine." And he'd run out of the room with his white coat flapping behind him. And then they look at me in terror and say, "What are you going to do to me?" You know, and I say, "I'm going to touch you and make you feel better." Well, this was a totally revolutionary idea because no one in the hospital had ever done anything but poke them and make them feel worse.
Right.
So I began with very simple things, just very simple pain relieving processes, you know, kind of sensing where the pain was in their body, showing them how to move it, how to get the body to take on the entire emotional feeling of the physical pain and relieve it. But I started getting very curious about the operating room. And Oz was quite frankly terrified about having me in there and how it was going to look. So I waited very patiently, and finally there was a favorite patient of his who became very fond of me because I'd cured his insomnia. He hadn't been able to sleep after the surgery. And I said to him, "Would you like me to be in the operating room when your heart comes in?" He said, "I would love it." So I said, "Okay, well, you talk to Dr. Oz, and I'll talk to Dr. Oz, and we'll see what we can do." So the next time I saw Oz, I said, "Mehmet, you know, I'd really like to be in the operating room when George's heart comes in." He looked at me sort of suspiciously, and he said, "Well, how does the patient feel about this?" I said, "Well, why don't you go talk to him?" And the next thing I knew, he said, "You know, okay, you know, that I could come in and be there for the surgery."
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. And were heart surgery and cancer type things your two primary areas when you were in the hospital?
Well, I worked mostly in heart because I worked mostly with Mehmet, and the other people in cardiac got to know me. And then I met the chief of neurosurgery, and he invited me to come over, so I did a lot of work in neurosurgery. And then I got a grant to work with women having surgery for breast cancer.
Mm.
And I got a grant originally to work on the East Coast, and then I got a grant to work with women out here in the Bay Area, and that's what originally brought me out to California.
Mm.
And then I became, and then I had a was given a visiting professorship at California Pacific Medical Center. So I came out and I did a public lecture and a public workshop. I did grand rounds in medicine, grand rounds in psychiatry, and at the same time had this grant, you know, to work in surgery. And that's when I started coming to California and started, you know, teaching here and seeing patients here and running workshops here, and eventually moved out here.
What are some of the biggest maybe areas of trauma that you see coming up over and over again for people?
Well, the two greatest and most secret areas are sexual abuse. I mean, over and over again. I used to see it, of course, a lot when I was looking at endometrial surgery, any kind of pelvic surgery, anything like that. But it's actually, sexual energy is so fundamental to human life that kind of wounding affects people in a myriad of ways. Lots of fibromyalgia, lots of chronic fatigue, lots of exhaustion, you know, but all kinds of things. Lots of obesity, lots of eating disorders, lots of addiction stuff related to that. Insomnia, because sexual abuse so often happens at night from somebody coming into the room at night. You know, the first thing I ask with someone with insomnia is, "Well, what was going on in your family at night?" You know, so that's, and the other, which is even more scary, is abortion attempts, unknown abortion attempts. I mean, so many women really are in a panic when they discover they're pregnant and try to do something, really, to get rid of the child. And this is, as far as I'm concerned, is the great hidden secret of our society. Mm. And, of course, they never tell the child, because what a horrible person you would be if you wanted to get rid of a child.
Right.
So very often, although if there isn't abortion attempt, there's abortion ideation, which means the mother thinks about getting rid of the child.
Mm.
And then to cover her anxiety, she smokes or she drinks or she eats a lot of sugar during the pregnancy and makes the fetus, the most helpful being there is, feel very, very unsafe.
Mm.
And these people grow up with, you know, constant anxiety, never know where it is, never feel safe in the world, no matter how successful they are, how much money they make, how many lovers they have, they always feel disasters right around the corner.
Mm.
So that's the other. And I would say the third thing is a kind of inattentiveness during infancy,
mm.
where the mother, for whatever reason, really can't show up completely and be present for the infant, either because, you know, she's having problems in her marriage or her own infancy was very troubled and memories, unconscious memories of that are coming up. These are enormous factors in disease which are never looked at.
Wow.
So, Julie, I want to ask, how do we, you know, let's just get back to trying to make this truth about health and our reality as palatable as possible. Because whenever we do speak about emotions, and clearly there's, I mean, there's such a foundational component here about the impact on health and disease and all these different factors. But it's also, I mean, it clearly is our most sensitive area where we're most vulnerable to hurt. And we have so many triggers and things in place that prevent us from even wanting to, you know, to talk about it. Yet, our thing with Healthful Living is really trying to help people expand their options for their well-being. And clearly, you know, we're talking about, you know, 90% of the pie here that's not even being looked at most
mm-hmm.
of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are listening and they're getting curious, how do we help make the subject matter even more palatable to them so that they can even just begin to be curious themselves about, you know, whether they engage, whether they, you know, look up your book or work or whatever it is, how can they just begin to get, you know, a little bit more introduction to just looking at this area of their emotional connection to their health?
Well, of course, in my vanity, I'll suggest my book or
mm-hmm.
attending one of my workshops, or I run healing groups in the Bay Area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would be my first most self-satisfying suggestion. and I'd like to give people information about getting in touch with me. But the most important thing is really to listen to the body. The Body Never Lies, which, by the way, is the title of a wonderful book by Alice Miller. If your body is hurting, if you're tired, if you find yourself, you know, characteristically having a certain kind of problem at a certain time of day, you know, there's no reason for us not to be happy. You know, there's no, you know, we are really not put here to suffer. You know, we're put here to be curious and have a good time. And any time that's not happening, any time you're not feeling curious and excited about life, which is the natural state, and any time you're not, you know, feeling that life has a potential for tremendous enjoyment, there's something wrong. You know, and it's not true that things get worse as you get older, you know, and that the body has to break down. These are all myths. What really happens is if you continue to lie about what has happened to you in your body for long periods of time, it wears the body out. So, you know, the best I can say is to be attentive to the body, to listen to the body, to ask a part of the body, if the body, part of the body is aching, close your eyes and say, well, how old are you? You know, and maybe you might get the answer four. And you might want to go back and say, okay, so what was happening in my life when I was four that my elbow is now remembering?
Mm.
I mean, that's a very good technique to ask yourself, like, what age is this part of my body bringing me back to? And see what memories you can tolerate having, you know, bringing up. You could ask your mother what the pregnancy was like, although you will probably not get a straight answer. You'll get some clues. There are breathing techniques. If you lie very quietly and breathe as if you're breathing through your navel, through your belly button, you can take yourself back to what it was like to be inside your mother and breathing through your umbilical cord.
Mm.
And just see what that was like. You know, just begin to get some information that way. Look at old photographs and look into the eyes of the child in those photographs. Really look into those eyes and see what emotions come up and see how they might relate to your current life.
Mm. I know that, so I've taken one of Julie's group classes, which is wonderful. And one of the things I learned in that was when I started having strong emotional experiences when I would hear a story of somebody else, that started giving me big clues. So when I got teary-eyed over, who knows, home birth or natural birth or the birth process or something, it's like, okay, there's something that must be here for me, because why would I have this totally unconscious reaction to this thing that I don't have any conscious connection to in such a strong way? Mm-hmm. So I found that that also...
That's a very good clue. The kinds of movies you respond to, even the kinds of lyrics in a song. Mm. You know, if you find yourself suddenly cheering up when you hear certain lyrics, or the kinds of images on television that you respond to. That's a wonderful insight. That's a really wonderful insight.
So before we close here, how can people get more information about you?
Well, they can call me on the phone. I'm open to that. It's, my number is 415-256-2528. 415-256-2528. Unfortunately, I don't have a website yet, but if they email me, I'll be glad to send them information about, you know, current, you know, workshops and groups. And my email address is Julie Motz. It's JULIEMOTZ @ 4 Energies, and that's the number 4 spelled out, FOURENERGIES. So it's Julie Motz @ 4energies.com, and I dedicatedly answer all my emails and respond to all my phone calls.
Wonderful.
So, and I've really found, you know, living in the Bay Area quite wonderful in terms of the depths that people are willing to go to and the risks they're willing to take to heal.
Yeah, this is not something for people faint of heart.
Definitely not. Definitely not. And the other important thing for healing is to have loving people around you. We're only going to heal to the extent that we feel safe. And so, you know, to have friends, to value friends. And for very wounded people, sometimes friends are difficult to have. A pet, even to have a work of art you go and look at all the time. You know, to give yourself that comfort and support. Because works of art represent love that an artist has put out in the world to comfort us and to hold us.
Wow.
Are there any, just before we let you go, Julie, are there any, like, categories of people or significant maladies that we would say that groups that we would people that we would highly recommend that they begin to look inward for solutions rather than constantly looking outwards for them?
Our politicians. I think if we get our politicians to look at their personal histories and their personal wounds, it would totally transform the country. We have a country being run by angry babies. And their sense of deprivation and their rage about that, their unclear rage about that, is wreaking havoc with the world. So if we could get the politicians to look inward, that's the group I'd most like to see.
That's so interesting, because whenever I think of a certain president we know, I think, I feel like he's a five-year-old in a sandbox.
Yeah, I don't think he's as mature as that. I think you're giving more credit, really.
Well, anything else? I'm just thinking in our... in our finishing moments here, that I would love to give some insight to people. Maybe, boy, this is such powerful and profound work, but it's also, like you said, it's, you know, it's kind of scary and you need some good support.
Well, I would suggest that people be compassionate with themselves. I myself am recovered from eating disorder, you know, and the kind of thing that easily promotes self-loathing. And one of the big steps, you know, before I was able to uncover all the trauma behind it, was to reach the point where I would observe myself. And I would say, and develop compassion for a person who is so desperate that she has to do this to her body to feel okay, to calm herself. So whatever your issue is, you know, whether it's an addiction, a compulsion, you know, a physical malady, the first step is compassion. How to feel compassion for a person whose body would have to do this in order to survive. You know, so that would be what I would say, to cultivate compassion for yourself, you know, and as opposed to judgment or despair or anger with yourself.
And I know that you do both group classes as well as private consultations. How would somebody choose which environment? Are there benefits to both of them?
There are benefits to both. I love group work because I like having the input of a whole bunch of different people and all kinds of different energies and information, but it's not the same kind of focus, or quite frankly, the same level of safety as one-on-one work. Because with the group work, you know, you don't exactly know where everybody in the group is going to be for everything you're sharing. Although as the groups mature, they become safer and safer and safer. So, and people very often, and I just usually discuss that with them, and we sort of make the decision together.
You know, the one thing, I would normally be, I suppose, the shy type looking to do private work so that nobody has to see my, you know, deep hidden things that I think nobody else has and that, you know, I'm the only one with. But then the group was actually really helpful for me because I realized everybody, every single person in that group had something going on. And interestingly, many of the stories, although different circumstances, were very similar. And that alone, I think, can be really helpful for people to realize in a way of having compassion for yourself because, you know, we often feel like we're the only ones that are, you know, messed up because we only know our own experience, to realize, wow, there's lots of people that have had lots of things and different struggles that people go through. So I think that there's actually, you know, something really powerful in the group class if you're, you know, if you're at that comfort level with it.
And the other thing about a group is that you don't have to speak up until you're ready. Whereas in a one-on-one session, you pretty much, you know, the clock is ticking, you've paid all this money, you really want to start talking soon. Whereas in a group, you can kind of hang back for a week or two or take your time or even not participate at all and just be there as a witness and learning from other people's stuff. So it has that advantage.
Right, great. Well, we have been speaking with Julie Motz, that's M-O-T-Z, and she has a book, Hands of Life, Use Your Body's Own Energy Medicine for Healing, Recovery, and Transformation. And why don't you give your contact information one more time for people?
Yes, people can call me at 415-256-2528 or email me at juliemotz@4energies.com. That's J-U-L-I-E. M-O-T-Z at foureneries.com.
Great. Well, Julie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for a great interview. I really love the questions.
Thanks.
Thanks, Julie.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, bye. Well, you are listening to KPOO San Francisco. You're listening to Reality Sandwich with Julie and Martin Matthews. And we are going to take a short musical break after that wonderful interview, and we will be right back. You are listening to KPOO Reality Sandwich. We are back after the break, and we have been talking to Julie Motz, who is a wonderful energy healer, and she teaches classes and private workshops and private private consultations here in the Bay Area. And you know, I just want to talk about it a little bit more before we move on to other subjects. But I, you know, the more and more that I learn and study and contemplate my own existence, the more I realize this is such an important piece. And like she says, people don't always want to know the truth because I guess it's a little messy. It's a messy at the beginning part when you first figure out really either what happened or you know, where you currently are in time and space. Because when we start to look at these, you know, let's say we have depression or we have anxiety or something, and you know, there's a stage that people often go through where, you know, there's self-judgment, like, oh, I'm a bad person because I am depression or something. And then to get into, well, why we might have depression means that we have to look at ourselves and our experiences and things that happen. And that's really difficult. And there's also a level of judgment that often comes along with looking at that. Like, oh, maybe we had certain strategies that don't seem so smart right now. But at the time, when we look back, they may have been smart. But if we're looking with our current lens, there's often a lot of judgment of, you know, why couldn't I have just done this? Or why did I have to pick up on that? And, you know, all of those kinds of things. So the beginning parts can be a little bit, you know, difficult until we learn that there really is no judgment, that, you know, how do we have control over what happens to us in the womb or the childhood imprinting that we pick up? That's how nature works, so that we survive, so that we learn from the parent. We don't know that there's, that we're picking up on negative things that aren't going to necessarily be the most healthy for us in the long term. So I think that idea of compassion really is the beginning step, because I think so much suffering is due to us feeling, you know, not good enough, and that there's something we are or something we think or something we do or some way we look or something that is, that we might judge and perceive as you know, a reflection of who we are. And it's not the case.
So often it's easier to have compassion for someone else.
I'm good at that.
Right. But applying it for ourselves, we have so many things in place that inhibit us from giving it to ourselves. And it's all this inner talk about, you know, how flawed we are or how we should have known better. And it's all that broad category of judgment and judgment and judgment and judgment about what is,
right,
about the current moment and how we are and in the past. And all of that just inhibits us from even being in the present moment to address and look at what is, because we just automatically take it right down into a negative space.
Well, you know, you studied organizational psychology, you know, with a master's from Columbia, and in that study, it sounds like to me you learned a lot about psychology of the individual, and you were telling me in the past about how humans evolve with this need to learn from our parents and other things. Anything that stands out for you in terms of, because I know you've done a lot of thinking about whether it's, you know, learned helplessness or whether it's optimism or anything that just about the human development and the individual person that...
Well, I've been studying this stuff, really, I would say all of my life. I think 25 years, clearly, that I've been fascinated with, longer than that, with the nature of human condition and how we are and what the patterns that we pick up and how we develop over time and what's running our inner circuitry, right? And this reality that we are taking on everything that we experience, everything that happens to us is somehow imprinted. And whether we use terms now, whether we say that's imprinted emotionally or energetically or whatever, we're all inside, we're all organisms, we're machines. We are responding to all the stimuli that take place in our...
Well, let's not say machines. We're organisms.
Organisms, yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for keeping me straight with the metaphors. But we're organisms, and we are... constantly responding to these things. And a lot of stuff happens before we have the critical faculty, right? The ability to begin to apply our consciousness more and making a choice about how we respond to something that happens. And so in those younger years, we don't really have that. So we just have to react automatically, right? And the body is wired to protect itself. I mean, these are things that we're meant to do. It's in our DNA. It's in our cellular structure to protect ourselves from pain. And yet, things happen that are painful that we can't yet explain to ourselves because we don't have that development to make sense of it.
Right. And if one of those things happens that's so painful and we don't have the capacity at 5 years old or 2 years old to process it and understand it, then what do? We store it in the body at the cellular level. And then what happens? It shows up as pain or disease.
It doesn't go away.
Right.
It can't not go away. Experiences that have happened to us have happened. They are there. They
never. Not, you said it can't not go away.
It can't not ever always be there. I'm using this kind of funky language, but it doesn't go away by suppressing
by suppressing it. It only can
and
go away.
And it takes
away.
Energy to maintain suppression, whether it's in an individual or an organization or a team. We've all been on teams or companies where we all know that something happened or something went down that wasn't really cool, but nobody talks about it.
Right.
And there's this illusion that it's gone away.
But then there's all this individuals. Yeah.
You have to put energy into, I'm constantly remembering that we're ignoring that.
Right.
Right. So it takes away from one's capacity to actually be fully present with what is in order to use all of the energy of the present moment to help heal or help to make the future as best as possible, as healthy as possible, however. So when Julie's talking here about experiences earlier in our life that we may not even remember but occurred around us, like with the example with the heart, I'm most fascinated by that notion that the patient's body wasn't receiving the heart because they had emotional imprinting that was averse to receiving it. And if you begin to think about that, on the one hand, it's very easy for us to go, oh, that's woo-woo, that's crazy, you know, science says chemicals, whatever.
It's just coincidental.
And while we have that conversation, simultaneously we have to have a conversation where even in those predictable so-called scientific circumstances, there's still 90% of the stuff we can't explain, right? There's all this other stuff we can't explain. And time and time again, we're learning from experts who have been out there actually helping people with, again, emotional healing is a pretty broad-based category, whether it's emotional or energetic, whatever we call it. And I don't believe it should be called alternative. It should just simply be called healing because it's helping the body to remedy some of these unsorted out stuff from its history in order to open up its capacity to be in the present moment and to deal with what's happening here and now. And in the case of that heart recipient, Yeah, she was able to help them facilitate an emotional opening
mm-hmm.
that allowed for the receptivity of this new heart, and even speaking to their heart that was being donated.
Right.
We know now that all things have a consciousness. All things come with a historical and an energy.
Mm-hmm. If people listened to our show a couple weeks ago on quantum physics and the actual scientific study they've done on these things, it's really interesting.
And that our energy and our intention affects things outside of us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even me now hearing myself talk, I would say even 5 years ago, I would think that this conversation was a little more kind of out there woo-woo. But you know what? We had a Newsweek magazine, I think it was Newsweek or Time last year, very clearly stating like 90% of all disease, you know, has emotional, you know, origins.
Well, they know that because one of my grandmothers had some heart condition, and they said that there is a higher prevalency of depression among people with heart problems. So, you know, just interesting things like that, like what's going on emotionally that might be affecting somebody. And if you think about that, what happens when in an emotional situation you have heartbreak?
Right.
So what do you have with a heart that's not working? You have heartbreak, right? So it's very interesting to see this piece, and it shouldn't be underestimated. And at the same time, I have to say that, you know, there's so many ways that you can get at this same information, that there's lots of different wonderful therapies and things that you can do, or exercises, people you can work with. So, you know, find the one that resonates with you. But, you know, usually cognitive therapy, which is wonderful, you know, at some point only takes people so far. At some point, going into more of a somatic, body-centered experience of what they're feeling in their body can really help to dialogue in areas. Like when we're in the womb and when we're infants, like she said, if so much trauma is often done there, but, you know, we don't have any recollection of it, and we don't have a parent that necessarily is consciously aware of, you know, the experience that the fetus or the infant had, or isn't necessarily willing to share it, or, you know, whatever that might be. How do we even know if these things are true? And how do we know what's going on at that level to try to heal it? So that's where the body piece comes in, because, you know, we don't have to, quote, know from a cerebral level. We can feel. We can feel when we watch, you know, when we watch, what was her name? Carrie Shrug? Is that her name?
Carrie Shrug.
And the gymnast and people teared up because of, you know, the courage and the strength that she had and everything. You know, when those types of things resonate with you, they tell you something about what's going on, either in a positive way or something traumatic for you. And so sometimes it's like, well, how do I know that that really happened? Well, does it feel right? Does it feel like the truth on some level? Even though you don't, quote, technically cognitively know all the physical details. You know, if you don't necessarily have to know them all. If it feels right, often you end up being able to release some of that stuff that was stuck just by acknowledging this feeling of there's something in this area.
Right, because if it's being held, then it's being held in the cells, and the cells affect everything. I mean, that's what your body is comprised of several trillion cells.
Right.
And whether it's and there's so many modalities. I mean, I can speak, you know, a little bit certainly, of course, to the use of hypnotherapy to help access historical experiences mm-hmm. in our subconscious that are stored in there, right? That are not at the conscious level. And then when the two merge and we become aware of that, it can become clear. So it's not being held. And then certain physical manifestations will shift. Things will change, whether you're shifting a habit or my personal fascination is with, you know, what's going on physically and where the body, where past trauma is being held, unbeknownst to our conscious mind, that's manifesting physically somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And once that awareness becomes open, then we can become present to the current moment, and the body can do what it's supposed to do, which is intended to be healthy and regenerative, and
mm-hmm.
and we can clear these things.
Right.
So, and the main key here is simply to help us to have compassion for where we are in the moment.
Yeah.
And to move past the pattern of criticism and self-judgment, because that's all a symptom of the stuckness.
Yes. Yeah. And so much suffering has to do with just our own judgment of the process and where we are right now. You know, it's always like where we are right now isn't okay.
For some
reason.
Because
we want to grow and we want to be somewhere else. And we feel frustrated that we're here and we judge ourselves because we're here, you know, and it creates so much suffering when, like Julie said, if you can just have some compassion for yourself and where you are and why you're here and understand more about it, it can really make a profound difference. So I'm so thrilled that we had Julie Motz on the show, and you can find her book, Hands of Life, at Amazon and a variety of different bookstores. So let's just go on in our last, we only have a few minutes, you know, a little bit left in the show here, but I know there were some things that you wanted to do and give an update for everyone. We've been talking a lot about this raw milk bill and what's going on in California with the raw milk legislation and some new, some really wonderful things we found out last week, and then some little bit of concerns about some funny business and things. So why don't you, before you go into that, for those of you who haven't been listening on a weekly basis, there, we had on last month Mark McAfee, who is the founder and owner of Organic Pastures Dairy, who makes raw milk and raw milk products. And that's, you know, for those of you not listening, those are unpasteurized products. And there's a lot of Californians and consumers that really feel strongly about the benefits and the health benefits of this raw milk. But there's so much in the mainstream saying how you know, bad it is, and there's, which is, in my opinion, untrue. And there's so many lobbies for the kind of commercial dairy industry that there is some funny business creating a new law that would make it very difficult to get raw milk available. So why don't you take it from there?
Well, Reality Sandwich is proud to have really been one of the few, if any, organizations to speak about the truth of the subject
a couple of months ago. Big raw milk fans. We drink raw milk, raw cheese, raw butter, all those things in our household and love them. And so we are not only here on the show talking about it, but have really strong feelings in our personal life as well.
Well, and back after we had discovered, and Mark had let us all know that there had been a requirement thrown into a bill that kind of snuck through the state assembly and was signed by the governor, that would have made it challenging to produce this standard. It had nothing to do with the actual safety of raw milk. And it was kind of like somebody pulling a fast one to try to inhibit raw milk in California.
Right.
And we had this whole show about that, and we had Mark on, and we had another gentleman from Washington, and Sally Fallon was on him. And we were just essentially saying that this, you know, this was absolute BS coming from the state, and that this was just some attempt to inhibit raw milk, even though it had nothing to do with the standard. And it turns out that most of what we had talked about in that show was actually true, and that most of the assembly people didn't realize that that's what this was going to do.
And they were actually pretty upset, in fact.
Very upset.
What is it, earlier this week or last week when I don't know if we have the quotes, but there were some assembly people, and they had some quotes about being very feeling misled, mm-hmm. feeling like some funny business. In fact, some fairly strong language from a couple of the assembly people being really upset by the way that this was not discussed in the mainstream, that they didn't bring the public in, they didn't bring any of these experts in, and it looked like that they were going to kind of reverse this bill with a new bill, and maybe you can give some update.
Well, here's a piece. It says, in a rare scene seldom witnessed at the Capitol, Assemblywoman Nicole Parra admonished the CDFA for its deceitful attack on the democratic process and for misleading the legislature, saying that such a process will not stand. She insisted that AB 1604, which is this new bill that they're putting in place, pass out of the committee and said it would fail over her dead body. She was particularly passionate about the fact that the CDFA had cheated the people out of the democratic process. Republican Assembly Whip Mike Villanez strongly supported Nicole, saying a mistake had been made which will now take courage to correct. Assemblyman and Agricultural Committee member Tom Berry wanted to search for who in the CDFA did this, stating that heads should roll. So here, something wacky has gone on in Sacramento that really wasn't very cool, didn't follow process, didn't inform the two major companies that are producing raw milk in California, and someone was trying to pull a fast one that would prevent all of us healthy people in California from having raw milk. Shame on them.
Right. Okay, and so now they had this bill, 1604, that they were going to vote on. They were going to send it to the assembly floor for a vote.
Apparently, everybody had agreed, this is going to be fine, we're going to get this thing in place. And then we got some news this morning from Mark.
And then I will let you read about that.
Well, apparently this thing was supposed to go straight to the assembly for quick signing, and now this morning we get an email from Mark saying that this AB 1604 bill has been sent to the Assembly Appropriations Committee, which is... they're thinking some action that's intended to sneakily kill it because it's not supposed to go to the Appropriations Committee bill. And that he's thinking now that the CDFA and big dairy interests might be getting involved here in some dirty backroom political game to kill it in some sort of friendly committee that would simply label it as an appropriations bill and knock it out, as opposed to what it's supposed to be, which is something that's helping to rectify this problem that's taking place. I'm not getting all the verbiage correct here, but the issue, apparently, we had thought a few days ago, was hands down, everybody at the state seems to be agreeing that raw milk should not be inhibited in California and that they're going to get this legislation corrected. And now, even here at the last minute, there seems to be some more backroom funny business going on. But, you know, these people are powerful, the CDFA, and they think they know what's
CDFA
right.
CDFA is
California Department of Food and Agriculture.
Thank you.
They're the ones who originated this whole movement to try to sneakily pass this coliform standard that had nothing to do with safety. And
right, because they have a lot of interest in the big, big, big dairy people that they have a lot of money. So I guess there's a couple things that you can do if you – either number one, believe in raw milk, or number two, I think even more importantly, because if you don't know about raw milk, you may not be a big believer in it. But I think what's a more important point than raw milk itself is taking away the individual's freedom to have access to food that is safe and let the individual person decide what they want and what they don't want. And that, to me, is a bigger issue than just this. And one of the reasons that we are big fans, if we could say, of Ron Paul, who is very into individual freedoms and states' rights and things like that. So one of the things that you can do is to go on to the Organic Pastures website, which is organicpastures.com. And they have all sorts of information on actions that you can take. They are suggesting that you call all of the assembly members that sit on the Appropriations Committee and demand that AB 1604 pass the committee and really let them know, the assembly people, that, you know, that this is really an important issue that we're not just going to take lightly.
Right. So in the next few weeks on Reality Sandwich, we have a show next week with Jeffrey Fawcett. We'll be talking all about the Sustainable Health Institute and the work that he's doing together with Lena Berman from her show on KPFA, Your Own Health and Fitness, that Julie was on about 2 weeks ago. And
if if you haven't seen that interview, then that's also – or heard the interview, I guess you wouldn't see it. Then you can go to our website. Which website do we have that on? Is that Nourishing Hope?
Nourishing Hope. They can get a link from
So there. NourishingHope.com will have that one.
In 2 weeks, we'll be doing a show all about career change. Many people now are thinking about what they're going to be doing with their careers, wanting some more alignment or shifting careers in some way.
Yeah, with their passion and how they want to make positive change in the world versus just being,
exactly,
you know, on the corporate wheel.
Susan Bernstein, she was a past guest from Within. She'll be on the show. And then on the 14th, on Valentine's Day, we're very excited to be speaking with Daniel Pinchbeck.
Mm.
He's the author of a book called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl.
I can't wait.
And we'll be speaking all about changes that are happening in our world.
Mayan calendar.
Consciousness,
and
Mayan calendar.
Very
and
exciting. Really fascinating stuff.
And then later in February, we're doing another show with Raymond Francis on alternative cancer treatments. So we're packing it in for the next several months on Reality Sandwich with all kinds of various subjects, all empowering your personal choice for being happy and healthy and healthful living.
So for any of you who want more information on Martin and myself, you can go to healthfulliving.org. If you would like information on this show, or if you'd like to listen to this show or any past shows, of course, you can go to that website, or you can go directly to realitysandwichradio.com. And I think that's it for this week. I want to thank everybody for listening. Stay tuned every Thursday at noon for a palatable taste of the truth during your lunchtime hour. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and I'm here with
Martin Matthews. I'm a certified clinical and medical hypnotherapist with Healthful Living. Thanks for listening.